This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday, so that means time for the Week in Review. Beginning with the big announcement by President Obama yesterday, creating the Atlantic Ocean's first national marine monument.
Our oceans feed us, protect us, regulate our climate, our weather, anchors industries from transportation to tourism to trade of all kind. The health of our planet's oceans determine in large part the health of our own bodies and the health of our economies.
Again, that's President Obama announcing the creation of the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument, the first such marine monument in American Atlantic waters. It sits 130 miles off Cape Cod, is the size of Connecticut, an aquatic treasure worthy of protection, according to Tim Shank with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution.
They have live corals and fish, a variety of ecosystems, sponge ecosystems that are often found nowhere else on Earth. And these seamounts are very important scientifically because we believe there's places where new species form.
But the president's executive action means an end to fishing in the newly created monument. So here's Beth Cassoni with the Massachusetts Lobstermen Association.
If you want to save a piece of coral, people will throw tens of thousands of dollars at it. But if you want to save a fisherman, they'll tell him to get another job. And it's not that easy. There's a reason why people fish. They love it. It's a way of life. It's ingrained in their souls. And, you know, it's not that easy just to tell a fisherman to go get another job.
Well, joining us now to discuss this and the rest of the week's news is Charlie Chipio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and a research fellow at the Ash Center at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Charlie Chipio, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Also with us today, Shira Springer, investigative reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Hi there, Shira.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a long week. I'm sorry. I'm tripping over all over my own words today. So let me just turn it over to the two of you. First, thoughts on the creation of this new marine monument. Charlie, let's start with you.
Well, you know, I can't claim to be an expert on marine monuments and these kind of things, but I think that a couple things kind of really interest me about this. You know, one is this whole issue that it raises about the fishing industry. And I kind of wonder, to some degree, if the fishing industry at this point is really salvageable around here. You know, it seems like we've overfished for so long, and then you add in climate change and those kind of issues. And you know, I wonder, you know, if this is something that we can fix at this point. And I guess the other thing that comes to mind is that it's the latest example of this kind of dysfunction we have in Washington, where President Obama did this under this 1906 Antiquities Act, mm-hmm. executive order power, and some are saying it circumvents this 1970s legislation about how we regulate fisheries. And to me, it just seems to be the latest example of the dysfunction down there.
Okay, so Shira, your thoughts?
Well, I agree with Charlie with regard to the questioning the salvageability of the fishing industry in New England. I think there's some, you know, I just wonder if we've passed the point of no return yeah. at this juncture. However, I don't agree with you, Charlie, with regard to the dysfunction in Washington. I think that Obama actually had to do this and do this with a sense of urgency because you don't know what's going to happen in November. And we seem to have pushed these conservation efforts off for so long that we're now digging ourselves out of a hole with regard to conservation, particularly with ocean conservation. And there, again, with ocean conservation, there also reaches a point of no return. You've done so much damage to an area that it can't mm-hmm. be rehabbed and it can't come back to life, particularly with these corals. And what I see with this reserve here, this preserve, this marine monument, and what I understand about it is there's some really, really unique features mm-hmm. there. There are canyons that are deeper than the Grand Canyon. There are mountains, underwater mountains that are the highest mountains east of the Rockies. And there is this coral life that is very rich and diverse, and that if you have people in there fishing, you risk destroying it. And I think you have to take these steps. You have to take bold action. And sometimes you have to take quick action, maybe under the cover of mm-hmm. darkness, so to speak, mm-hmm. to get it done. Because if you push it off, then you'll do damage that's irreversible.
Charlie, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, well, a couple of things. One, my in terms of fishery, that comes from grave, you know, extensive personal experience in going out there and not catching anything. So that's what
grave
I know about
experience.
That. Yes. I mean, I'm not saying he was wrong. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that you know, in a perfect world, this would have been done through a different process. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying that I think he was wrong to do it. I'm just saying it's the latest piece of evidence in terms of the way things work down there.
Okay.
Don't work down
well,
there.
Let me just play a little bit of tape here. It's a little tough to hear, but it's worth sort of craning your neck to listen, because we spoke with John Williams. He's the president of the Atlantic Red Crab Company. He's a red crab fisherman. Now, they get 7 years before they have to stop fishing there, but he was actually at sea on his fishing boat talking to us over a satellite phone when we spoke with him yesterday, and here's what he said.
I would prefer that the process went through the public process the way that all other fishing management did. This is not a good day for the fishing industry.
So, Shira, let me turn that back to you, because this idea that President Obama used an executive order rather than going through the public process, we've heard that from a lot of other folks in Massachusetts. Not that long ago, we spoke with the mayor of New Bedford, who said exactly this. And it's an issue. Apparently, I mean, according to John Williams, all other fishing management does go through this public process.
Agreed. I mean, it is an issue, and it's unseemly on the surface. And I think they have a valid point. You know, it's troublesome in some ways that it went through this executive order. And, you know, admittedly, there are processes in place. There have been, you know, efforts to sort of balance conservation efforts with commercial fishing. However, it seems to me from all that I've read about the fishing, these efforts take an incredibly long time. And they're dependent oftentimes on what the national administration, what the configuration of that is, Republican versus Democrat, people who believe in climate change versus people who don't believe in climate change in power. And so I think the great fear is that if you put this off and open this up to the public process, this is 10, maybe 15, maybe 20 years down the road, and you're not saving this. It's already gone.
We don't have that long.
Yeah. You don't have that long. And also, let's be honest, there were some compromises made. This was a much larger area originally. The Connecticut Congressional Delegation wanted a much larger area covered, and they reduced that. And also, I believe it's lobster and red crab fishermen have that seven-year grace period so to make adjustments. Now, I know it's going to be hard to find other areas to fish, and everything is a bit overcrowded with regard to fishing areas, but I think there was some good faith effort on the part of, you know, Obama and his administration to make the transition as painless as possible.
Right. Well, Charlie, I'm going to turn back to you in a second, but I want to play sort of the other side of that coin, because yesterday we also spoke with Tim Schenck. He's from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, and he actually talked to us about how the creation of this marine monument may actually help fish stocks.
We need them for fisheries. We have juvenile fish, a variety of species that use these corals as their sanctuaries, as their hatcheries. So scientifically, they're very important to us, and we don't understand much about them. We've only been studying these canyon areas for the last 5 years.
So, Charlie, you can share your thoughts about that with us, but I'm also wondering, since suddenly it popped in my mind, since this is an executive order, this could get turned around in November anyway, right?
Yeah, it could. I think it's one of these questions where how far along is it? You know, does it become unrealistic to stop it? But, I can understand why, why he would do this. And logically, I'm no expert on the fishery, but it does make sense that if the more you protect it, the more you have an opportunity for these fish to sort of come to maturity and develop, and maybe for the stocks to increase. I mean, it seems to me that that's been the problem up until now, the political inability to say, hey, look, you know, we've got to really cut down on this or else it's never coming back.
Yeah.
But that's a hard thing to implement.
You know, it was interesting that this is a decision that has made some strange bedfellows. We noticed that both Governor Charlie Baker and Senator Elizabeth Warren expressed some concerns about the creation of the monument. Charlie Baker said in a statement that his administration is deeply disappointed by the federal government's unilateral decision to undermine the Commonwealth's commercial and recreational fishermen. And Senator Warren said in a statement, the ocean and seafood industry are critical parts of our coastal economy. I'm disappointed that this process ultimately culminated without broad stakeholder consensus. Shira?
They have their right to their opinions. But I keep coming back to the same argument, which is these types of decisions are taking, at this point, we're at a critical juncture. And if we don't act now, it's going to be too late. And and there's so much uncertainty about the politics around this. I think Obama felt that sense of urgency. And, you know, as he said in his remarks, I mean, the ocean impacts everything. It impacts the economy in ways besides fisheries.
It impacts
the climate, the health of our bodies.
It is the climate regulator.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It is the climate regulator. And this particular area, it's worth mentioning, I believe, is increasing. The temperature of the water there because of climate change is increasing three times faster than other ocean areas. So this is a really, really critical area that is under siege and changing faster than other parts of the ocean. So it seems like this was almost an emergency situation that they were dealing with, as opposed to other ocean areas.
It's interesting, at the end of a presidential term, too, sometimes you can find out things, what really matters to these folks. You know, it's
this legacy. Comes
on, you know, and this comes on the heels of doing a similar thing in the waters off Hawaii,
and that one's much larger.
Clearly, he sees this as a high priority.
Well, this is a guy who grew up in Hawaii, you know, body surfing off the waters of Hawaii. So clearly, the ocean has I think a personal pull for him.
And I think the only other thing I would add is, you know, I understand what Senator Warren said about consensus, but you know what.
You're never going to have consensus. You're going to either have the environmentalists and the activists angered, or you're going to have the fishermen angered. And I think they, like I said, in good faith, tried to reach some sort of compromise with a smaller area in the 7-year, transition period for lobstermen and red crab fishermen. But like you say, Charlie, there's never going to be consensus with an issue like
this. Well, let's move on to another story from this week's news. And that has to do with more terrestrial concerns, if I can put it that way. on the streets of Boston this week, Boston police finally launched their body camera pilot program. And again, just background here, Boston Police Union had agreed to participate in the program, but then it was supposed to be voluntary and urged officers not to volunteer to wear the body cams. Last Friday, a Superior Court judge ruled that the police commissioner does have the authority to assign officers to the program. So that meant that this week, on Monday, 107 Boston police officers started wearing the cameras. And on Wednesday, we spoke with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, and here's what he said.
There is definitely tension out there in the communities in certain neighborhoods. Body cameras can't build trust in a community. They're there to take a film, an interaction. What builds trust in a community is actually interaction with the community, with what young people in the office, in the community. That's what we need, the officers in the community to interact.
So, Charlie, what's your thoughts that this pilot program has finally gotten off the ground?
Well, just that it should have gotten off the ground a long time ago. Look, we live in an environment where we've had too many examples in the last 2 years of particularly African-American males getting shot in the back for reasons that are tenuous at best. And if we're going to have faith and we're going to have a system that works between police and the public at large, we're going to have to do things that increase trust between those two entities. And I think something like this is the kind of basic thing that we have to do. The research shows that cameras tend to reduce complaints against police. And I guess my only question, the one thing that I sort of wonder about this, and this is a very simple question, which is that the idea is that they're supposed to sort of switch this on whenever they have any interaction. Well, I can see a lot of, oops, I forgot to switch this on, and I wonder sort of what the response to that's going to be.
I think that's the beauty, though, of the pilot program, which is they have these 100 officers.
Right.
It's 6 months. And listen, I think they did a good job. They have a diversity of officers. I believe they come from the five sections of the city, plus the youth violence strike force.
Yep.
They're black officers, white officers, Latino, Asian officers, 87 men out of the 100 chosen to wear the cameras. So I think, they're going to have a wide sampling. I think that's the beauty of a pilot program. You get to see and study, okay, where did this policy fall short?
You get to work the kinks out.
Exactly. And this, and I think that's what will happen. Well, they'll start to see, okay, so when they're pulling over drivers, maybe they're not turning on, we may need to put a time period, when you're approaching the car, that's when you turn the camera on. I think they'll be able to, iron out the kinks, as you say.
One thing that keeps staying with me is that, what impact this long fight has or had on community relations between BPD and the people of Boston. And in fact, on Tuesday, Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans spoke to Channel 2, and he said this about the fact that, a lawsuit had to, or they had to overcome a lawsuit in order to get this pilot program off the ground.
It sent the message that we're hiding something. And, and the longer we were fighting it, the more people think that, we're doing some bad things out there. And I tried to say, we're not perfect, but I think we're doing great.
Again, the lawsuit came from the police unions. But Charlie and Shira, I wonder what you think about that, because whether or not it's true, Commissioner Evans himself is saying it sent the wrong message, this long fight.
And he's right. And, you know, look, I think it's in, you know, if you look, take a bigger look at this from sort of 30,000 feet. Look, the reality is that, as he said, Boston is certainly not perfect, but boy, if it's like this in Boston, and the situation between the community and the police is way better in Boston than it is in Baltimore or Baton Rouge or a mm-hmm. whole lot of other cities in the United States. And I think it really speaks to the challenge that we face with this issue.
Yeah, and I can understand, I mean, you can try to understand you know, what the police union president, Patrick Rose, was thinking. Basically, he was saying, you know, we had this agreement in place. It was right. going to be volunteers, and it was a signed agreement. So if you breach this signed agreement, what's to keep you? He saw a slippery slope there, and that was his argument and the argument they had during the hearing. And I can see where, if you're a union head, that would be something you would grip onto. But I do think it does, you know, create a bad image that you are hiding something, or that you don't want to do this type of policing, or that you don't want to use all the tools that might be at your disposal.
And I mean, that image, in a way, I have to say, is partially true, because the union itself that directed its members not to volunteer.
Exactly.
Well, that's just
exactly.
It. Who breached
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
Right.
Who breached it? Yeah. Exactly. Right. And I think, you know, the union and police officers are going to have to come to the realization that this is 21st century policing. When you have technology available, whether it's body cameras or data that can help you, better analyze crime statistics and better deploy your forces, you are going to be asked to use the technology, whatever it is. And they're going to have, I mean, change is tough, but this is where we are in the 21st century. We have this technology available. We have these incidences of police shootings that you know are under some sometimes mysterious or kind of questionable circumstances, and this is where we are at this juncture, and you have to kind of get on board at this point.
Well, there's another story that I want to touch on, because it's a national story, but it actually did touch down locally here in the past week, and that has to do with NFL players protesting during the national anthem. Now, a number of athletes just this past weekend joined San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick. He has been the one leading a protest of racial inequality and police brutality by not standing during the playing of the national anthem. Now, the players who have recently joined him and doing something similar, Pats players Martellus Bennett and Devin McCourty. Now, they both raised their fists at the end of the anthem before the Pats' Sunday night game in Arizona. Here's Bennett speaking to Comcast Sportsnet in the locker room after the game.
One of those things, let them know that this is something that we care about. This is something that we want to bring change in a positive way. We're not trying to be a distraction. We're just working to be a positive influence in our community. And I have friends who've been unjustly discriminated against, or, you know, all those things. And it's not just, you know, black, white thing. It's for all people. You know, it's just we want everybody to be treated fairly and just.
And it's not just happening at NFL games. Here in Massachusetts, at a Worcester High School football player, Michael Opong, knelt during a recent game. And here's what he told WBUR.
Black people don't get a lot of equality and are judged more by the color of their skin than their actions. And the national anthem is supposed to be a celebration of our rights as Americans. And if I'm not getting my rights, then I don't feel like I should be celebrating the national anthem.
So, Shira, let's start with you on this. I mean, athletes always run the risk of being told politics don't have any place on the field. And yet here we have, you know, pros all the way down to a high school player starting to say, no, there is a place for politics on the field.
And I say good for them. I'm actually happy to see athletes taking a more activist stance when it comes to issues of social injustice. I think it's about time. You know, there was this great period in the 1960s when you had John Carlos and Tommy Smith, who you remember from the 1968 Olympics, raising their fists on the medal stand.
I do. You two are too young.
Okay. A collective memory. And, you know, you had Muhammad Ali, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Jim Brown, even locally here, Bill Russell talking about social injustice. And then there was this period, I think, you know, where athletes started to get more money and endorsement deals where they feared losing that.
Right.
And they
The Michael Jordan syndrome,
the Tiger Woods syndrome,
rightly fearing, because there have always been consequences for players who speak out.
Exactly. But I think we've reached a new period. I think it may have started a few years ago when LeBron James made a stand and the, all of the Miami Heat put on their hoodies as sort of a tribute to Trayvon Martin. So I think there's been a growing tide of social protests, which I'm happy to see, as long as the athletes do it thoughtfully, because I think their run does run the risk that you have sort of a Curt Schilling, let's say, type figure who uses his sports celebrity as a platform to try, you know, to espouse ideas that controversial ideas and sort of say, this is the way it should be. My ideas are right.
But why
me.
Not, though? I mean, if Colin Kaepernick can espouse ideas that some people also find equally troubling, why not have, you know, more conservative athletes do the same?
I draw a distinction between what Colin Kaepernick is doing and what, you know, the Worcester High School football player. They're at least they say they're trying to raise awareness and start a discussion. I don't think Curt Schilling is particularly interested in starting a discussion. He's interested in hearing himself talk.
I want to come back to you on this, but Charlie, let me get your thought.
Well, look, I think that this and the body cameras, I like to think I have a nuanced view of these things, but I think these are two that are just clear cut. You know, these guys have a right to express their opinions and to, you know, express their views in a free country. And the reality is that, yeah, I very much prefer the way that Kaepernick has done this and the way that Michael Opong has done this to what Curt Schilling has done. But Curt Schilling has the right to do it his thing, too. You know, the reality is, you know, that these guys have not done anything wrong. I mean, they haven't disrupted anything. They're just expressing their opinions, and especially the kid from Worcester, I got
to
tell you,
that takes courage.
Yeah,
and to be a high school kid and do that.
As a parent, you know, the view I've come to have is I don't really care if I agree with the positions my kids take. What I want them to be able to do is to be able to tell me why they're doing it and express their opinions clearly. And he's been able to do that.
Yeah, to think about it, to be passionate about it, to have a cause, to be committed to a purpose. I think those are important lessons, particularly for high school kids.
And absolutely. Yeah, because they risk so much going forward also.
Yeah.
But, you know, Shira, I've been reading that some folks are saying that Colin Kaepernick right now is the most hated man in the NFL.
Yeah, but his jersey sales are number one. So I don't know how you measure hate. With respect to that, you know, I think there are probably some team executives and team owners and NFL executives that wish he wouldn't be taking the stand and wish that the stand hadn't grown into a larger movement across the NFL. But I question whether he's the most hated man in the NFL.
Well,
I think that's a little bit strong. Yeah. And I think that just by the
Roger Goodell.
I was going to say, yes, it's Roger Goodell. Number one, I think he has a strong case there. But I just think that judging by the way the movement has spread to other teams and other players, and not only other teams and other players, but other sports. I mean, there's a woman, Megan Rapinoe, who is with the women's national soccer team, who's also protesting.
Right.
So this is not just limited.
And she's white.
And she's white.
Yep.
And, you know, this is not just about football. And I think to say that he's the most hated man in the NFL and to see the movement it started is false.
The thing I wonder is, sort of sports fan to sports fan.
Yes. Charlie.
Would he have done this when he was, a couple of years ago, when he was a starting quarterback and an all-pro? You know, interesting that I'm not knocking
you know
him, but
what?
It's just interesting that he's doing it now that he's
Well, I think he's doing it now. One, I think he probably would have. And, you know, there are major name, big name players who are starters who are doing this. So I don't think that, you know, I think what's happened is he's seen more incidents.
Yeah.
And I think you reach a point of frustration, and that comes with age and experience. I mean, don't forget a few years ago when he was starting and all
a lot
pro,
of this stuff hadn't happened.
A lot of this stuff hadn't happened, and he was young.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see a lot of the older players doing this because they know and they experience, and they also feel a little bit more comfortable in their skin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's one last question I want to ask you guys before we move to our hubbubs, and that is that a couple weeks ago I heard Kareem Abdul-Jabbar give an interview on NPR, and he was talking about, you know, Muhammad Ali and his own acts of political speech and the consequences they had, and he was asked, well, did it make a difference ultimately in terms of the cause that you were speaking out about? And Kareem Abdul-Jabbar said yes, because it raised awareness I mean, is that enough?
I think it is. I really think it is. I think to get people talking about, I mean, listen, they talk when these shootings happen and then it sort of dies down and you hear nothing about it, or maybe, you know, there's a news report here or there. But this has been a pretty, ever since Colin Kaepernick kneeled down in his first, I guess it was a preseason game, you know, a few weeks ago, ever since that happened, there's been a pretty constant conversation about not only the protest, but a little about what they're protesting for. So I think raising awareness, because sometimes that awareness, you know, creates change. It's not instantaneous. It may be a year or two or three years from now. But I think just the momentum starts building, and that's
and
what you have
I
here.
I think it's easy to say that, to ask that question, if you don't necessarily remember those times. And I think somebody like my dad, who was not a hater by any stretch, a wonderful, loving guy, and I just remember how enraged he was by Muhammad Ali in 1970. And that was just so typical of people back then. And that whole attitude has dramatically shifted over these 40 years.
And I mean, you know, I've got to just jump in here, Shira, because our producers are looking at me. And they're like, if we only had a 24-second shot clock out here to move
need
the
one.
Conversation
along,
because we really are running down on time. Good conversation, though. But let's just sneak in our hubbubs, if we can, in the last couple seconds that we have here. And Shira, I'm going to start with you.
All right. Well, I will start with the researchers at MIT. They have come up with something better than X-ray vision, at least where ancient books are concerned. So using terahertz radiation technology, they've figured out a way to read books through their covers. Now, you're asking, how does this work? Well, a terahertz camera shoots pulses of radiation at an old book, one with pages that would likely crumble if you open them. And then the researchers measure how long it takes for the pulses to bounce back. Those measurements are fed through a letter recognition algorithm. By the way, this is way above my head technologically. That algorithm was developed by the folks at Georgia Tech. And voila, you get a reproduction of the text on the pages inside the book.
Oh,
and I
fantastic.
Think this is it's great news for historians and for people who want to delve into these ancient books, but they can't. It's too dangerous, at least from a crumbling standpoint.
So this
standpoint.
Means that when my kids are sitting there staring at the book, they can now actually tell me that they're reading.
Yes, exactly. That's what's coming. That's 2 or 3 years down the road. And then it will be osmosis, Charlie. You don't even have to have, you know.
I remember that technology
the book in
from
front
when
of
I was
them.
A kid. Charlie, you're hubbub.
Well, being back here on the BU campus where I went to college, it got me thinking about this upcoming marijuana ballot initiative this November.
We need more time.
But, you know, the recent poll showed that the yes votes on this to legalize marijuana are likely ahead, a BUR poll, actually. And it was interesting, I read in the Boston Herald the other day that Stephanie Pollack, who's the state secretary for transportation, one of her top priorities, she said, is if this passes, she is going to develop the equivalent of a breathalyzer test to determine if people are driving under the influence of marijuana. So all those who are anticipating, you know, this the legalizing marijuana, it's like that old Talking Head song, watch out, you might get what you're after.
She's got a fight on her hands about
know,
that, because there's a lot of dispute about whether you can accurately measure and whether different people are,
metabolize it differently
and what effects it has on their driving.
Another indication that there are so many levels to all these questions, right? And that's the latest.
Never an easy issue in public policy.
So before I give you my hubbub, I just want to actually throw out a reminder to listeners about something else entirely, because we've been doing this series of debates over the four ballot questions. Voters will be facing in November. Last week, we had a very spirited one about question two and charter schools. This coming Tuesday, it'll be the second in our debate series, and we're going to be tackling question three. That's the one that proposes to limit confinement of some farm animals, egg-laying hens and breeding pigs, for example. And for anyone listening, if you want to attend the debate, they're great fun. They're at UMass Boston. Go to wbur.org/events and register now, and you can get some tickets there. And, of course, you can always listen live Tuesday at 3 o'clock
on Radio
Boston. And
I was at the last
Boston.
One. You should go. They're great. Well, very interesting.
See, we got support right here from Charlie. Okay, so that was my little plug for our debate series. My hubbub actually has to do with a concert that I wish I had gone to this week, Adele.
Oh, me too.
Yeah, I mean, apparently it was...
I thought you were going to say Springsteen.
No, I think we're the Adele crowd. It was a great concert. Apparently, all the reporting and reading I've done about it said she did a wonderful job. But my hubbub has to do with the fact that she gave a shout out to a local donut maker. To Blackbird Donuts. And apparently Adele really loves their Boston Cream Bismarck Donuts. And good for them. They were besieged by customers the day after the concert looking for Adele-approved items, and they had given some to her. So good shout out for Blackbird. And now I have to say, I've tried their donuts, but I've never tried the Boston Cream Bismarck. Have you guys?
I have not.
Better get there. They said they ran out by 9 o'clock in the morning.
I know. I wonder when sales are going to slow down.
I want to try that, and then I want to have her here for carpool karaoke.
Well, you better get it quick.
You and James Corden.
She says she's not going to tour for a while now to raise her son, right?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, so.
Okay, well, on that note, then let's just close with a little Adele. Well, Charlie Chipio is head of Chipio Strategies and a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and also a research fellow at the Kennedy School of Government. Charlie, have a great weekend. Thanks so much.
You too. Thank you.
And Shira Springer, investigative reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Always great to have you, Shira. Thanks
Likewise.
So much.
Likewise. Donuts and Adele on my list.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.